This is Audible.
Hay House Audio presents Left to Tell, Discovering God Amidst the Rwandan Holocaust by Immaculée Ilibagiza.
Forward. You're about to embark on a journey that will undoubtedly change the way you view the power of faith forever. A single phrase from the Scriptures reminds us that with God all things are possible. I've quoted this passage frequently in my lectures, often adding the rhetorical question, "Now what does that leave out?" All things means all things. Well, I'm happy to report that when you've completed listening to this program, you'll have a new perspective on what the field of all possibilities looks like. As you bear witness to Immaculée Ilibagiza's transcendent experience in the midst of a Holocaust too horrible to even contemplate, you'll also understand how the limitless power of pure, undeterred faith can indeed work to create miracles. Despite the hideous display of humans' inhumanity to each other that was taking place only a decade or so ago in the country of Rwanda, this is truly a love story in the purest sense of the word. A story of the triumph of the human spirit. A story of one woman's profound faith and determination to survive against literally impossible odds in order to tell her tale and to be an agent for ushering in a new spiritual consciousness. And a story of a love for God that was so strong that hatred and revenge were forced to dissolve in its presence. Her story will touch you deeply. You will feel her fear, you will cry, and you will ask yourself the same question that we as a people have been asking forever. How could this happen? Where does such hatred come from? Why can't we just be like God, which is the source for all of us? But you will also feel something else most profoundly. You will feel hope. A hope that inch by inch, we as a people are moving toward a new alignment. That is, we're moving toward living God-realized lives. To me, Immaculée was not only left to tell this mind-blowing story, but more than that, she's a living example of what we can all accomplish when we go within and choose to truly live in perfect harmony with our originating spirit. And I am deeply honored to speak these few words in this program that you are about to immerse yourself in. I assure you that as you do, you'll move to a place just a few inches closer to living in oneness with the same divine essence from which we were all created. I love this program, I love her book, and I love Immaculée Ilibagiza. Wayne Dyer.
My name is Immaculée Ilibagiza. This is the story of how I discovered God during one of history's bloodiest genocides. Part 1. The Gathering Storm. Chapter 1. The Eternal Spring. I was born in paradise. At least that's how I felt about my homeland while I was growing up. Rwanda is a tiny country set like a jewel in Central Africa. She is so breathtakingly beautiful that it's impossible not to see the hand of God in her lush rolling hills, mountains, green valleys, and sparkling lakes. The gentle breezes drifting down from the hills and through the pine forests are scented with the sweet aroma of lilies and chrysanthemums. And the weather is so pleasant year-round that the German settlers who arrived in the late 1800s christened her the Land of Eternal Spring. The forces of evil that would give birth to a Holocaust that set my beloved country awash in a sea of blood were hidden from me as a child. As a young girl, all I knew of the world was the lovely landscape surrounding me, the kindness of my neighbors, and the deep love of my parents and brothers. In our home, racism and prejudice were completely unknown. I wasn't aware that people belonged to different tribes or races, and I didn't even hear the terms Tutsi or Hutu until I was in school. In my village, young children walked 8 miles to and from school along lonely stretches of road, but parents never worried about a child being abducted or harmed in any way. My biggest fear as a youngster was being alone in the dark. Other than that, I was an extremely happy little girl in a happy family, living in what I thought was a happy village where people respected and cared for one another. I was born in the western Rwandan province of Kibuye, in the village of Mataba. Our house was perched on a hilltop overlooking Lake Kivu, which seemed to stretch out forever below us. On clear mornings, I could see the mountains on the other side of the lake in the neighboring country of Zaire, now called the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Some of my warmest childhood memories are of clambering down the steep hill between our house and the lake. I'd go swimming with my dad and brothers. The water was warm, the air cool against our skin, and the view of our house high above the shore always thrilling. Heading back home was an adventure because the hill was so steep and the dirt beneath our feet was loose and treacherous. I often slipped and was afraid that I'd tumble all the way down and into the lake. My father always knew when I was frightened, and he'd bundle me in his arms all the way home. He was a big, strong man, and I felt safe and loved wrapped in those powerful arms. It thrilled me to be lifted up so affectionately, especially since Dad was very reserved in an old-fashioned way and rarely showed his emotions or said he loved my brothers and me, although we knew he did. When we got home from our swim, my beautiful mother would be busy in the kitchen, preparing the hot rice and bean dish she fed us every day before packing us off to school. Her energy never failed to astonish me. Mom was always the first to rise and last to bed, getting up hours before anyone else to make sure that the house was in order. Our clothes were laid out, our books and lessons were ready, and my father's work papers were organized. She made all our clothing herself, cut our hair, and brightened the house with handmade decorations. The beans she prepared for our breakfast were grown in our family fields, which Mom tended every morning while the rest of us were still sleeping. She checked the crops and would make sure that our cows and other animals were fed and watered. And then, after finishing the morning chores and getting us off to class, Mom would walk down the road to start her full-time teaching job at the local primary school. Both of my parents were teachers and adamant believers that the only defense against poverty and hunger was a good education. Despite being one of the smallest countries in Africa, Rwanda, which is roughly the size of the American state of Maryland, is one of the most densely populated countries on the continent and among the poorest in the world. Mom and Dad were the first high school graduates in their families, and they were determined that their children would go even further than they had in school. Dad led by example, working hard and studying throughout his life. He received many honors and promotions during his career, rising steadily through the ranks from primary teacher to junior high school principal. He was eventually appointed chief administrator for all the Catholic schools in our district. In Rwanda, every family member has a different last name. Parents give each child a unique surname at birth, one that reflects the feelings of the mother or father at the moment they first lay eyes on their new baby. In Kinyarwanda, the native language of Rwanda, my name, Ilibagiza, means shining and beautiful in body and soul. My dad chose my name, which will always remind me how much he loved me from the moment I was born. My father's name was Leonard Ukulitinyinhindi, and my mother's was Marie Rose Kanyindi, but her friends called her Rose. They met at one of my cousin's homes in the summer of 1963 and married within the year. My parents managed to save a little money by holding down teaching jobs and farming the land my grandfather had given them. They grew and sold beans, bananas, and coffee. Dad designed and built our house, which, while extremely modest by Western standards, was considered quite luxurious in our village. We had a kitchen, a dining area, a living room, our own bedrooms, a guest room, and Dad even had a study. The solar panels he installed provided us with about an hour of electricity on sunny days. We had two vehicles, which was practically unheard of in our part of Rwanda. We had a yellow cross-country motorcycle that Dad used to visit schools in the remote mountain villages, and we also had a little car that we used on weekends to go to church and visit relatives. Some villagers thought that we were wealthy, which we weren't, and they called my dad Muzungu, meaning white man or rich person, which to most Rwandans meant the same thing. No one else in our village had a motorcycle, and Mom always worried that Dad would be waylaid by bandits on a lonely mountain pass. Fretting about her family was a preoccupation with my mother, to the point that whenever any of us was away from home for more than a night, she'd listen to the obituaries announced on the radio every evening. Mom, think of all the good things that could happen to us instead of dwelling on what might go wrong. I urged her unsuccessfully. Oh, Immaculée, I couldn't bear it if someone knocked on the door with bad news about one of my children or your father. I just pray that I die before any of you do. She prayed incessantly for our health, safety, and well-being. My parents were devout Roman Catholics and passed on their beliefs to us. Mass was mandatory on Sundays, as were evening prayers with the family at home. I loved praying, going to church, and everything else to do with God. I especially loved the Virgin Mary, believing that she was my second mom, watching out for me from heaven. I didn't know why, but praying made me feel warm and happy. While my parents were ardent Catholics, they were Christians in the broadest sense of the word. They believed in the Golden Rule and taught us to treat our neighbors with kindness and respect. They felt strongly connected to their village and dedicated themselves to creating a prosperous, harmonious community. Dad spent many weekends doing volunteer work, such as building a non-denominational chapel and paying for most of the construction costs out of his own pocket. Mom was also known for her many good works. She could never turn away anyone in need, so we often had another family living with us because they'd fallen on hard times and needed a place to stay until they got back on their feet. After finishing work, my mother volunteered her time to tutor students, and she was forever buying material to sew new uniforms for local schoolgirls. Mom and Dad treated the village as our extended family, and the villagers often treated them like surrogate parents. Dad had a reputation across the region as an educated, enlightened, and fair-minded man. Consequently, people traveled for miles seeking his counsel on family problems, money woes, and business ventures. He was a good diplomat and always made people feel as if they'd resolved their own problems. My mother was also sought out for her advice, especially by women having difficulties with their husbands. Over the years, so many of our neighbors had once been mother's students that most villagers just called her teacher. But while they were certainly dedicated to our village, my parents were devoted to their kids, spending as much time with us as possible. There were four kids in the family, myself and my three brothers. The eldest was Aimable Dukunyagwe, who was born in 1965, a year after my parents were married. Even as a child, Aimable was the most serious member of the family. He was so quiet and introspective that we joked he was the family priest. Mom doted on him because he was her firstborn and her favorite, but Aimable was humble, shy, and embarrassed by the extra attention she paid him. He was also sweet-natured and detested violence. When the other boys roughhoused or fought with each other, he would step between them and make the peace. When Dad was away, Aimable took his place, making sure that we finished our homework, said our evening prayers, and got to bed on time. Then he would stay up late, ensuring that the doors were locked and the house was secure for the night. He seemed so much older than his years, but he was a loving brother to me, never failing to ask about my day, how my studies were going, and if my friends were treating me well. There was a 5-year age difference between Aimable and me. I was only 7 when my brother went off to boarding school, and after that, we saw each other only on holidays and special get-togethers. Nevertheless, I developed a terrible stomachache the day he left. Although his school was in a nearby town, as far as I was concerned, my brother was moving to the moon. It was the first time I felt the physical pain of losing someone you love. 2 years after Aimable was born, my other big brother came into the world. His name was Damascene Jean Muhirwa, and he was brilliant, mischievous, funny, generous, unbelievably kind, and irresistibly likable. He made me laugh every day, and he always knew how to stop my tears. Damascene. To this day, I can't say his name without smiling or crying. He was 3 years my senior, but I felt as though he were my twin. He was my closest friend. He was my soulmate. Almost everyone who met Damascene loved him. His easy smile and jovial nature was infectious. He was a class clown, but also a brilliant scholar, consistently among the top students in his school, and he went on to become the youngest person in the entire region to earn a master's degree. He studied constantly, but somehow managed to find time to earn a brown belt in karate, become captain of his high school and university basketball teams, and serve as chief altar boy at our church. I cried for a week when he left home for boarding school and felt like I'd never laugh again. He was the light of my life. The baby of the family was my little brother, John Marie Vieni Casanesa, born 3 years after me. Vieni was a wide-eyed innocent who was lovable but pesky, as all younger brothers are, I suppose. He'd grow up to become a handsome, strapping young man who towered over me. But in my eyes, Vieni was always my baby brother. I never stopped feeling like it was my responsibility to look out for him. He was a precious boy who followed me everywhere like a puppy dog. I became so accustomed to his constant companionship that I missed him when he wasn't around pestering me. I was the third child, and the only girl, which, in a male-dominated society, put extra pressure on me. In Rwandan culture, having a good name is everything, and my parents were vigilant in making sure that their only daughter maintained a spotless reputation. They were stricter with me than with my brothers, giving me more household chores and more rigid curfews, selecting my clothes, and approving or disapproving of my friends. My parents pushed me to succeed in school and develop my mind. But as a young woman in a very conservative society, I was still expected to be seen and not heard. How ironic that I was the one left to tell our family story. Chapter 2, Standing Up. Tutsi, stand up. Half a dozen chairs scraped backward across the floor as 6 kids in my 4th grade class jumped to their feet. I didn't have a clue what was happening, since I'd always attended my mom's schoolhouse. Now that I was 10 years old, it was my first day at the school for older kids, and I was confused by the commotion. I'd never seen a teacher take ethnic roll call before. All Tutsi, stand up now! Bohoro, our teacher, yelled. He was checking off names from a list with a big pencil, then stopped and stared directly at me. Imakile ilibigiza. You didn't stand up when I said Hutu. You didn't stand up when I said Twa. And you're not standing up now that I've said Tutsi. Why is that? Bohoro was smiling, but his voice was hard and mean. I don't know, teacher. What tribe do you belong to? I don't know, teacher. Are you Hutu or Tutsi? I don't know. Get out. Get out of this class and don't come back until you know what you are. I collected my books and left the room, hanging my head in shame. I didn't know it yet, but I'd just had my first lesson in Rwanda's ethnic divide, and it was a rude awakening. I ran into the schoolyard and hid behind some bushes to wait for my brother Damascene to finish class. I'd been fighting back tears, but now I cried until my blue uniform was soaked through. I didn't understand what had just happened, and I really wanted to go back to class and ask my best friend Janet to explain it to me. She'd stood up when the teacher called out the name Hutu. Maybe she'd know why our teacher was so mean to me. But I stayed crouched in the bushes until Damascene found me there, still whimpering. Who hurt you, Immaculée? Asked my big brother, with all of the authority of his 13 years. Damascene had always been my greatest defender, ready to go to war if ever anyone slighted me, so I told him what Bohoro had said. Bohoro is not a nice man, my brother said. But don't worry about it. Next time he does the roll call, just do what I do. Stand up with your friends. Stand up when your friend Janet does. Janet stood up when he called out Hutu. Then stand up when they call out Hutu. If that's what our friends are, then that's what we must be. We're all the same people, aren't we? I had no way of knowing then, but Damascene was as clueless as I was about tribalism in Rwanda, which was odd, considering that we were among the best educated kids in the area. Every day after school, my brothers and I were allotted just 90 minutes of free time before being summoned to the living room to do our homework under Mom's supervision. Dad took over an hour before dinner, setting up a classroom-sized blackboard in the middle of the room. He handed out pieces of chalk and grilled us on math, grammar, and geography. But our parents didn't teach us about our own history. We didn't know that Rwanda was made up of three tribes, a Hutu majority, a Tutsi minority, and a very small number of Twa, a pygmy-like tribe of forest dwellers. We weren't taught that the German colonialists and the Belgian ones that followed converted Rwanda's existing social structure from a monarchy that under a Tutsi king had provided Rwanda with centuries of peace and harmony into a discriminatory race-based class system. The Belgians favored the minority Tutsi aristocracy and promoted its status as the ruling class. Therefore, Tutsis were ensured a better education to better manage the country and generate greater profits for the Belgian overlords. The Belgians introduced an ethnic identity card to more easily distinguish the two tribes, deepening the rift they'd created between Hutu and Tutsi. Those reckless blunders created a lingering resentment among Hutus that helped lay the groundwork for genocide. When the Tutsis called for greater independence, the Belgians turned against them and, in 1959, encouraged a bloody Hutu revolt, which overthrew the monarchy. More than 100,000 Tutsis were murdered in vengeance killings over the next few years. By the time Belgium pulled out of Rwanda in 1962, a Hutu government was firmly in place, and Tutsis had become second-class citizens, facing persecution, violence, and death at the hands of Hutu extremists. Many tens of thousands died over decades when massacres were common occurrences. While the violence was cyclical, discrimination was ever present. The ethnic identity cards the Hutu government adopted from the days of Belgian rule made the discrimination more blatant and much easier. But these were history lessons our parents didn't want my brothers and me to learn, at least not while we were young. They never talked to us about discrimination or killing sprees or ethnic cleansing or racial identity cards. Those things weren't part of my youth. Everyone was welcome in our home, regardless of race, religion, or tribe. To my parents, being Hutu or Tutsi had nothing to do with the kind of person you were. If you were of good character and a kind human being, they greeted you with open arms. But my parents themselves had some horrifying experiences at the hands of Hutu extremists. And looking back, I can even vaguely recall one of them. I was just 3 years old and didn't understand what was happening. It was during the 1973 coup, when many Tutsis were persecuted, driven from their homes, and murdered in the streets. In our region, Hutu extremists were torching Tutsi homes one after another. My entire family stood together, looking down at Lake Kivu as the fires leapt up the hill toward us. We fled to a neighbor's. He hid us until the killings and burnings stopped. When we returned home, all we found was a smoldering ruin. My mother and father rebuilt our house and never discussed what happened, at least not with us children. And even though they'd been targeted in similar anti-Tutsi violence in 1959, I never heard my parents say one disparaging word against Hutus. They were not prejudiced. Instead, they believed that evil drove people to do evil things regardless of tribe or race. Mom and Dad ignored the social and political reality they lived in, and instead taught that everyone was born equal. They didn't want their children growing up feeling paranoid or inferior because they were born Tutsi. So it's not difficult to see why I was so confounded when my teacher, Buhoro, lashed into me for not knowing my tribe. Damasin draped his arm around my shoulders that day and walked me home. We both sensed that we'd been touched by something bad, but we didn't know what it was. At dinner that night, I told my father what had happened. He became quiet and then asked me how long I'd sat crying in the bushes after being ordered from the classroom. "Almost all day, Daddy." My father put down his fork and stopped eating, a sure sign he was angry. "I will talk to Bahoro tomorrow," he assured me. Dad spoke to my teacher the next day, but he didn't tell me what they discussed or what my tribe was, as he'd said he would. I didn't find that out until the following week, when Bahoro held tribal roll call again. My father must have shamed him, because he spoke to me in a much sweeter voice when he summoned me to his desk before roll call. "Immaculée, stand up when I call out Tutsi." I smiled as I walked back to my seat, thinking, "So I'm a Tutsi. Good." I had no idea what a Tutsi was, but I was proud to be one anyway. There were so few of us in class that I figured we had to be special. Besides, the name sounded cute and was fun to say. But I still couldn't see any real difference between the Tutsi and Hutu tribes. The Twa were pygmies, so their smaller stature made them easy to recognize. But since hardly any Twa came to school, I saw very few of them. The differences between Tutsis and Hutus were more difficult to spot. Tutsis were supposed to be taller, lighter-skinned, and have narrower noses, while Hutus were shorter, darker, and broad-nosed. But that really wasn't true, because Hutus and Tutsis had been marrying each other for centuries, so our gene pools were intermingled. Hutus and Tutsis spoke the same language, Kinyarwanda, and shared the same history. We had virtually the same culture. We sang the same songs, farmed the same land, attended the same churches, and worshipped the same God. We lived in the same villages, on the same streets, and often in the same houses. Through my eyes, we all seemed to be getting along. I couldn't begin to count the number of times my Hutu friend Janet and I ate dinner at each other's houses. As a young girl, the only time I was reminded that there were different tribes in Rwanda was when I stood up in class once a week during ethnic roll call. It was an annoyance, but it didn't bother me too much because I had yet to discover the meaning of discrimination. That is, until I wanted to go to high school. When I was 15 years old, I finished 8th grade second in my class of 60 students. I had an overall average of 94%, just 2% lower than the top student, a Tutsi boy, and far ahead of all the other students. It was more than enough to ensure a scholarship and placement in one of the best public high schools in the region. I went home at the end of the term dreaming about my new school uniform and wondering what it would be like to live away from home in a fine school where all the classes were taught in French. After high school, I planned to go to university, and after that, who knew? Maybe I would become a pilot, a professor, or even a psychologist. My parents had taught me that with hard work and determination, even a girl from a little village like Mataba could become someone important. How was I to know that my ambitions were just a silly girl's dream? I didn't know that those weekly roll calls served a sinister purpose, to segregate Tutsi children as part of a master plan of discrimination known as the ethnic balance. This was a plan pushed by Juvenal Habyarimana, the Hutu president who seized power in the 1973 coup. He proclaimed that the government must balance the number of school placements and good civil service jobs to reflect the country's ethnic makeup. Because Rwanda's population was roughly 85% Hutu, 14% Tutsi, and 1% Twa, most jobs and school placements went to Hutus. What the plan really did was keep Tutsis out of high school, university, and well-paying jobs, ensuring their status as second-class citizens. The true meaning of the ethnic balance was brought home to me a few weeks before I was to start high school. A neighbor dropped by as my family was sitting down to dinner and told us that my name wasn't on the list of scholarship students that had just been posted in the village hall. Despite my top marks, I'd been passed over because I was Tutsi. All the available places had gone to Hutus, who'd earned much lower grades. My father pushed his chair away from the table and sat with his eyes tightly closed for the longest time. I knew that my parents couldn't afford to send me to a private school, which would cost 10 times more than public high school. Both my older brothers were away studying, and money was tight. Besides, private high schools in Rwanda were terrible compared to the well-funded government-run public schools. The teachers were not qualified, the curriculum was inferior, and the buildings were ugly and uninviting.
"Don't worry, Emakile. We'll find another way for you to study," my father finally managed.
He excused himself from the table and went to his room without finishing his meal.
"Don't give up hope," my mother said, hugging me. "We'll all pray about this. Now eat your dinner."
After supper, I locked myself in my father's study and cried. I'd worked my heart out in school, only to have my dreams of a higher education dashed. I shuddered to think of what was in store for me. I'd seen how single women with no education were treated in my society. They had virtually no rights, no prospects, and no respect. Without even a high school education, I'd have no option other than to wait at home for some man to come and claim me as his wife. My future looked bleak, and I was only 15 years old. The next morning, my father wasn't at the breakfast table. It turns out that my father had left before sunrise to sell two of our cows so that he could send me to a private high school. Cows are status symbols in Rwandan culture and extremely valuable. Selling one was extravagant. Selling two was an invitation to financial ruin. But Dad was determined that I would get an education. He took his cow money, drove 3 hours south to a newly built private school, and paid my first year's tuition in cash. It was difficult for my father to express emotions, but it was impossible for him to conceal his love for me. My new school left a lot to be desired. The dorm room was tiny, and it had a cement floor and rough cinder block walls that cried out for a cheery coat of paint. I slept with 10 other girls on mattresses crammed so close together they took up nearly every inch of floor space. There was no running water, so every morning we grabbed buckets and hiked 2 miles to the nearest stream to fetch what we needed to wash and cook. And I missed my bed and my mom's rice and beans. However, no matter how hard it was for me to rough it, I was not going to quit school and ask my parents to bring me home. In fact, when it came time to choose our subjects for the year, I selected the most challenging courses, math and physics. Not only did I want to make Mom and Dad proud, I wanted to prove a point to my brothers. Like typical Rwandan men, they tease me about women belonging in the kitchen, not the classroom. Well, I'd show them. 2 years passed, and I was one of the top students in the school. When the government announced that it was holding a special exam for honor students who wanted to enter public school, I decided to take the test. Deep down inside, I felt that it wouldn't matter if I scored the highest test results in the country. I'd still be passed over because I was Tutsi. Nevertheless, I studied hard and was sure that I'd written an excellent exam. But weeks went by without any word, so I put it out of my mind. Months later, I was home on summer vacation when Damasin bounded into the house, bellowing at the top of his lungs, "Immaculée! Immaculée Ilebegiza! I just saw the list. You passed the exam! You've been accepted at Lycée de Notre-Dame d'Afrique. It's one of the best schools in Rwanda, and it's just down the road from my school." The family was sitting in the living room, and everyone went crazy. I jumped out of my seat yelling, "Thank God! Thank God!" and making the sign of the cross as I did a little victory dance across the floor. My mother had tears in her eyes, and my father shouted, "This is the biggest joy in my life. God has answered my prayers." We had a family party that night, one of our happiest celebrations in a very long time. Lycée was an excellent girls' school that many of the country's highest-ranking politicians had attended. Not only would I get the best education available to any young Rwandan, my parents wouldn't have to struggle with the private school fees anymore. The only drawback was that the school was far away in the province of Gisenyi. Since it was a 4-hour drive from Mataba along perilous roads, this meant that my parents wouldn't be able to visit often. And it was also located in a predominantly Hutu area, known for being openly hostile toward Tutsis.
"Don't worry, it's a girls' school," Damasin said. "They have a big fence and lots of guards to keep you safe. And my school is so close that I'll be able to visit you at least once a month."
I loved Lycée right away. The buildings were spacious, beautiful, and sparkling clean. The classrooms were brightly painted, and there were colorful flowers planted all around the campus. A high security fence ran around the entire complex, making me feel safe and secure. I was happy, And I knew my father would be too, especially when the nuns told us that we'd have to pray together before and after meals. It was difficult to venture beyond the campus walls. Whenever I did, I felt the eyes of the local people on me and heard them muttering, "Tutsi," in a menacing tone. The priests and nuns who ran the school made sure that the students and local residents never attended the same mass at the local church. We were issued strict orders forbidding us to leave school grounds without a staff escort. It was scary out there, but within the walls of the school, I never felt any ethnic discrimination. Teachers never took ethnic roll call, and while most of the girls were Hutu, we loved each other like we were family. I stuck close to campus, studied hard, and tried to keep myself from feeling homesick. Chapter 3. Higher Learning. Life was good at Lycée until war broke out in my third and final year. It was a beautiful sunny afternoon on the first day of October, 1990. My classmates and I were waiting for our civil education class to begin and wondering why our teacher was late. Mr. Gahigi was an easygoing, friendly man and perhaps the calmest person I'd ever met. So when he finally showed up wringing his hands and pacing back and forth at the front of the classroom, we knew that something was wrong. I wondered what bad news our teacher was keeping from us, thinking he was probably going to tell us that the nuns had canceled movie night. But it was something much bigger. We weren't allowed to listen to news broadcasts at school, so just like at home, I was isolated from what was going on in the real world. "I've just found out that there has been an attack on the country," Mr. Gahigi informed us somberly. "I'm afraid it's very serious and could have an impact on all of us for a long time to come." The class fell silent, and then everyone started talking at once, shouting out questions, wanting to know who was attacking Rwanda and why. "A group of Tutsi rebel soldiers living in Uganda has crossed the border," he replied. "They are mainly the children of Rwandan refugees who have banded together and are fighting to get back into the country. There is a lot of fighting going on right now north of here between the rebels and the Rwandan government soldiers." Mr. Gahigi was bombarded with a volley of frightened and indignant questions. "What do those Tutsis want? Why are they attacking us? What will they do to us if they reach the school?" I felt the heat of shame on the back of my neck and wanted to crawl under my desk. There were 50 students in the class, and 47 of them were Hutus. It was the first time I'd felt embarrassed about being Tutsi, and the first time I felt singled out at Lycée. "The rebels are soldiers fighting with the Rwandese Patriotic Front. That's a political association of Tutsis who left the country years ago and have been forbidden by the government from returning. And they're waging a war to get back into Rwanda and take over the government." I knew about the Rwandese Patriotic Front, or RPF, and I knew that the people in it weren't fighting simply to topple the Hutu government. They wanted to live in a country that was free and equal. Most of the RPF soldiers, the rebels, were Tutsi exiles or the children of Tutsi exiles. Hundreds of thousands of Tutsis fled Rwanda during the troubles of 1959 and 1973, as well as the many other times that Hutu extremists had gone on Tutsi killing sprees. They'd gone into exile to save their lives and those of their families. President Habyarimana enforced a policy banning exiles from ever returning to Rwanda. He'd created a Tutsi diaspora and entire generations of Rwandan Tutsis had grown up without once setting foot in their homeland. Mr. Gahigi didn't mention any of that, but he knew what happened whenever Tutsis fought back against extremist Hutus. He was worried for us, saying, "This could go very hard for Tutsis. This kind of thing can lead to many killings, so let's pray that the government and the rebels can settle their differences peacefully, and we avoid a lot of bloodshed." My shame slowly transformed into anger as I thought about how unfairly Tutsis had been treated. I silently rooted for the RPF, hoping that the rebels would beat the government soldiers and put an end to the discrimination. But by the end of the day, my anger had been replaced by fear, as I worried about my village and my family. I closed my eyes and said a prayer, asking God to keep my family safe because I didn't know how I would survive without them. Many of the students had relatives in the north, where the fighting was worst, so the school director allowed us to listen to radio reports and keep up with events. But more often than not, the national radio broadcasted little more than hate propaganda. The announcers claimed that the rebel soldiers lived in the forest like animals, ate human flesh, and consorted with monkeys. They said that the rebels had become so evil that horns had sprouted from their heads. Rwandans were warned to be on their guard because the rebel cockroaches were cunning and could strike any time, anywhere. These reports inflamed the hyperactive imaginations of already frightened schoolgirls. Not all the tension in the school was in our imaginations, though. One afternoon, we all went out for a picnic and were passing a group of local Hutus. One of the men was holding a big knife and waved it at me.
"Look at how tall this one is," he growled. "We'll kill you first. We'll make you pay for what your rebel brothers are doing."
My stomach churned and I thought I was about to throw up. It was the first time anyone had threatened me with violence, and I didn't know how to react. I ran back to my dorm, swearing that I'd never go on a school outing again. I cursed my height and wondered why being tall was such a crime in my country. What was I supposed to do? I couldn't stop being tall, and I couldn't stop being a Tutsi. We continued to listen to the radio for news, but the government station was notorious for its misinformation. We heard that the RPF had fought all the way to Kigali and attacked the presidential palace. The president went on national radio and warned people to stay in their houses until the army had killed all the cockroach invaders. Later, we learned from the BBC that there hadn't been any RPF soldiers within miles of the capital. President Habyarimana had invented the attack and lied on the radio in order to have an excuse for arresting thousands of Tutsis simply because they had relatives living outside the country. The president seemed paranoid, convinced that any Tutsi with a cousin in Uganda must be collaborating with the rebels. The BBC reported that so many innocent Tutsis had been arrested that all the jails in Rwanda were overflowing and there was no room left for the criminals. It was said that many of the Tutsi prisoners were being starved and tortured, and that some of them had been killed. When I went home at Christmas, my mother pleaded with my brothers not to sneak off and join the RPF rebels, as so many other young Tutsi men were doing. "If any of you boys go off to fight with the rebels, it would kill me. If you don't mind killing your mother, then go right ahead. Join the rebels. But if you love me, you'll each promise me right now that you won't disappear and leave me in agony. Now do it. Promise me." Mom had worked herself into such a state that my brothers promised her over and over they wouldn't join the rebels. I went back to Lycée, finished my last few months of high school, and wrote the university entrance exam. Once again, I had excellent marks and aced the test, but I held little hope of getting in. The ethnic balance was one of the things RPF was fighting to end, but at the moment, it looked as though it would put an end to my academic career. I said goodbye to my wonderful friends at Lycée and headed home for the summer to wait and see where fate would lead me. The war was intensifying. The rebels were winning more battles and pressuring the government to allow exiled Rwandans to return to the country and share power with the Hutus. Chapter 4. Off to University. Late in the summer of 1991, the impossible happened. I was awarded a scholarship to the National University in Butare. I had dreamed of going to university my entire life, and suddenly it was a reality, despite all the obstacles placed in front of me. When my parents heard the news, they were so excited that they couldn't sit still. They rushed around, preparing food and drinks so that we could celebrate in proper Rwandan style, with a feast. "You are the first girl in the family to go to university, so we have to let everyone know about this right away," Dad shouted, bursting with pride. He arranged for me to go on a long road trip the next day so that I could share the news with my grandmother, aunts and uncles, and all the cousins living in the surrounding villages. We stayed up all evening laughing, eating, and talking about all the good things that lay ahead. My parents seemed very young to me that night, as though a weight had been lifted from their shoulders. My mother was beaming. "Everything is looking bright for you, Immaculée," she said. "You will always be able to make your own way."